Hey everybody, I'm Chris.
Hey, I'm Bill.
Have you ever asked yourself, what is your superpower?
Everyone has a superpower. Most people just don't know what it is.
We're going to help you uncover it.
This podcast is all about helping people figure out what their truly unique superpower is.
Superpowers, what's yours?
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Superpowers podcast. Chris, we got ourselves a live one today. The first time ever.
First time for everything. It's with Deborah, which was, we've been working on this one for a while. First time for everything. Deborah, welcome to the Superpowers podcast show.
Hey, cannot tell you how excited I am to be here. Never know what's going to happen with you two.
Yeah. So Deb, because we've done all of about 30 seconds preparation for this, let me tell you how it goes. So the point of the Superpowers podcast is we bring on, you know, business leaders, entrepreneurs, political leaders, entertainment figures, and we go through their story. And as we go through the story, Chris and I in the back of our heads are trying to figure out what your unique superpower is, because we believe that every person has a unique superpower. And you know, success is how well you understand that superpower and use it to your advantage. So without further ado, we have ourselves an incredible guest. Again, first time doing this live, but Deborah Wall is the Global Chief Marketing Officer of General Motors. She's been in and out of the auto industry for a bunch of times. She was CMO of McDonald's. Probably her most, like, I think her mom's most proudest moment of hers was when she was elected to the board of directors of an exciting company called Media Ocean. Like GM and McDonald's are like whatever. And so we are super excited to have you on, Deb. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, the only thing that Bill left out with that intro is it's true that we want to discover superpowers. We also like to hear ourselves talk. So there's kind of another element that we enjoy about the show, but it's so nice to have you. We've heard such great things about you. And let's start with, you're the coolest dressed today. You have like the super cool Cadillac. Let's talk about that t-shirt and let's talk about the necklace. For the first time ever, I actually showered and for you, I got a haircut for you, Deb. I actually put on a button down for the first time in 4 months. So I just want to let you know, I went above and beyond for this show.
Oh, you know what? And you look amazing today. So yeah, I have to tell you the funniest thing was I too, you know, really have put it on for you guys. I actually blew dry my hair today, but then I had my whole outfit ready and I got up and my air conditioning broke today.
Oh, boy.
I'm sitting in my house, which is all glass. And then I said, you know, what's going to be comfortable? So I put on my Cadillac B t-shirt and decided that would fit perfectly in the mode, because behind me on my shelves I have a little miniature of the Blackwing V engine, which is also really motivating to me, and I figured I better get supercharged up for you guys today, and so that's what that's all about. And this is going to be coming your way, because I think you should be wearing these on your next superpowers webcast.
So I apologize, can you guys hear me okay now?
We can hear you great, Bill.
Okay, so sorry, I had some technical difficulties here. Hopefully it doesn't happen again. So I don't know at what point I lost you. But Deb, I'd love to start. Did you grow up in Detroit? Like, you know, what's going on with you in Detroit and auto?
Yeah, definitely. Motor City, born and raised. You know, my dad was in the business. He was a plant manager at a Chrysler plant. So I was in and out or around the business my whole life. But really interesting on how much it's changed. I did my first internship at General Motors back in the 80s, and it was an amazing experience. But also, I looked around and was like, wow, this is a tough industry for women. I just don't know.
Yeah.
And so it's so funny to come full circle after all those years. You know, so I guess that my first learning was you never know where you're going to end up.
It strikes me as it'd be a very tight community as relates to locals getting the jobs there and folks from Michigan and Midwest. Is that true, or kind of out of towners welcome as well to kind of get into a position that you're in today?
You know, I think it used to be, but we do have a saying though that we like to say that all good things come from the middle, especially the middle of the country. So we do like to see that, but no, I think now it's a really different mode. People come from all over and find a way to thrive here. But I have to say, like, if you're born in Detroit and grow up and live around here, there's a certain grittiness that's just in the culture overall, because it's a wild place here. You never know what's going to happen with the economy. You never know where things go up and down. So everyone learns to be very nimble, go through gritty times, and be incredibly tenacious.
Deb, M&M gritty or just below M&M gritty? Like, where on the M&M scale?
Yeah, I think it varies all around. You start to learn a whole appreciation for a whole different architecture and culture and everything that's going on. And that's why I always loved it. In fact, when I had my son, I brought him back here on my first time back after about 20 years after college, because I was like, I want you to grow up here in the Midwest, in Detroit, because it's like you learn to be really real and you learn how to do things. And, you know, it just, I always felt, nothing against any other place, but I love it here.
It's home.
So Deb, what, talk to us about like growing up. You talked about your dad kind of being in the auto industry. You have siblings?
I do. I am, of course, the oldest. I have two, a sister and a brother. Middle child and younger.
So you are the first
child.
this is season two. Every single person up until now was a middle child. I don't know why.
Isn't that incredible? It's true. Everyone.
Yeah. So you're the oldest.
Should we continue the show or just?
Yeah.
Okay.
So you were the oldest. Tell us a little bit about kind of growing up. What did your mom do? And what do your siblings do today? Are they involved in auto or anything?
So I was the oldest. Probably, if you ask my siblings, I was the bossy planner, always making them do the things that I wanted them to do, which I find to be a huge advantage later in life. My mom was a housewife, but she was incredibly busy. So it's so funny today as we look at how parents helicopter around. I don't remember my parents ever being around, really. I mean, I remember them showing up for dinner, but the rest of it, you know, we were home from school. We had the neighborhood gang that everyone was just outside all the time. It was great. I loved all that part of it. Dad was really hard worker. He had, you know, I said he was a plant manager, then he opened his own company. So he's an entrepreneur. So also went through all those ups and downs, and that taught me a lot. But funnily enough, after seeing all that, I've ended up being in big company business for the rest of my life. So.
You went the other way. So if your name was Lizzie, your siblings would have called you Busy Lizzie, the planner. But what was your nickname, Deb? What did your siblings call you as the busy planner that you were?
Well, usually it was Big D, because it was, you know, dominant and like, let's go. Like, we got it. I was always in a hurry to get something done.
All right. We'll find out the real ones. The other thing I was going to comment on is I grew up outside of Massachusetts, and you just said something that just back to the childhood that I grew up in. Those days when you just get on your bike and disappear for like 8 hours and you were meant to be at dinner. There were no phones, there were no texts. I still have no idea how it worked, but it worked. And now as a dad with 9 and 7 year olds, I definitely know I helicopter more than I did, but unfortunately today's generation does not have that complete and utter freedom that we had growing up.
Yeah. So true.
Yeah, I remember I would, you know, get up in the morning on like a weekend, and you have kind of like your friends from school, but you also have like kind of like the friends that lived around your house. And then you would go out and play, and then your mom would just call you at some point when the sun was setting and be like, Billy, dinner. And that was basically what my parents did on weekends, right?
So funny. I remember it was like either the banging on the pot or the yelling loud, or you know, you go to your neighbor's house and you go.
Exactly.
Ann, are you home? And you'd yell through the screen door, and that was how we did it all. It's hilarious, you know, so different.
Okay, so we're starting to get, you're the older sibling, you're a little bossy, you start learning your management skills then. Like, how were you as a student? Were you a good student, average student, excellent student?
Yeah, I think I was just above average. I mean, I always thought I was super smart, but then I looked back at my grades and SAT scores one time and I was like, oh my God, I would never get into anything today. I don't tell my son that, by the way. I just tell my girl that everything.
Well, now he knows. Now he knows.
Yeah. So, you know what my mom always tells me, I was the child that she never had to worry about. So I was always prepared. I always did my home, like I was always on top of everything, even though I do think I kind of skated by and did not. I was not, you know, cum laude. I wasn't any of that. But I was involved in a lot of things and incredibly social. I, you know, had a big social life going on.
It's interesting with their...
There you go. Well, listen. Go ahead.
It's interesting back to the sibling comment, because normally the older one kind of paves the way. They torment their parents. They make all the mistakes. And then the younger ones kind of cruise through. You made it really easy for your siblings.
Oh yeah, my mom was always very distracted, also by my middle child sister, who was the wild, crazy one who did, you know,
right,
got into all the trouble. I was like, I just put her in front, and I was, you know, the golden child. So
there was always one. Deb, did you have any side hustling when you were growing up in these neighborhoods with your friends, like, you know, lemonade stands to, you know, taking hubcaps off cars? Like, what did you do?
Oh yeah, we did it all. I mean, we were constantly looking at how do we make money. But, you know, back in the day, we were the girls, so we had bake sales constantly, and we had this great common area in our subdivision where there were parties all the time. It was actually a really great place to grow up in Rochester, Michigan. And yeah, so we were constantly making money, finding things to sell, experimenting, trying to start little businesses, the majority of which were always all around cooking or delivering or parties or something like that. But I can't say any of them were wildly successful, but we were at it all the time. So I worked from the time that I was 14 on.
Okay, great.
Wow. Yeah. You know, I kind of feel like the Generation Zers and whatever we're calling the new coronials or whatever the new group of is going to be, like, I kind of feel like that's the big difference, right? We, you know, growing up, we had independence. We had to, like, you know, make our own money. You know, it's a little bit different, right? So we got a picture of you as young Deborah. Like, where did you go to school?
I went to a place called Kingswood. It's part of this unbelievably gorgeous place called Cranbrook overall. It was the girls' school at the time. And it was built by Saarinen, thus my mid-century modern love and design. It's like a 350-acre campus, which has buildings and art everywhere. And it sort of, I had no idea then, because we were just running around and having fun in it. But, you know, it's like the most beautiful, amazingly designed place I've ever been able to, you know, grow up and live in.
And so that was boarding school for high school?
It's a day and boarding school, but I was a day student. Yeah.
Okay, so you were a day student there, and isn't it true your son, like, you sent your son there as well, right?
Yeah, I did, and he I sent him there. He loves it, and he went back and when we were still living in Chicago to be a boarder. And now that I've moved back, which I was all excited, I'm here. I'm like, oh, he's good. He's like, no, Mom, I'm staying to board. It's much more fun in the dorm. So I'm like a mile and a half away. But so I see him a lot. But, you know, that's what he loved. And back to that idea of, like, freedom. I think our kids need some freedom. Like, they have to learn how to survive on their own and do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Independence is good. Okay, so you went to this incredible school. What did you decide to do for college? And did you know, like, what you wanted to do when you were, you know, 17?
I always knew that I was going to be in business somewhere. And I anticipated, you know, I thought it would be, you know, starting a company, running a company, doing something like that. So I ended up actually, my first year out of high school, I went to Boston University. So I started there.
My daughter is transferring to BU.
Oh, really? Oh my God.
Yeah.
So much.
Yeah, she just made the decision like a week ago. Yeah.
Good school.
It's a great school. So much fun. But actually after a year, it was big for me. And then I have to admit, I got into a little trouble. It was a little wild. maybe in my first year of college. So then I had to sort of sit back time, and I ended up transferring to Wellesley, which is still out in the Boston area, and finished the college career up there, which was, you know, much, I absolutely loved it there.
Deb, it's good that you brought up the In the Trouble piece, because we were going to bring that up anyway. So it's good that you got ahead of it. And also, Bill, I'm sure you know that Wellesley's next door to Newton, the town I grew up in. So beautiful, beautiful town. Question, Deb, before you got to school and you...
No, it was Wellesley. Go ahead.
When you were, you mentioned your hardworking mom, and you mentioned your dad as an entrepreneur. Any sort of things that you picked up there, insights, learnings from your parents as you kind of gone on to your college career, as far as like how what were the things that you learned from your parents at that stage, or your appreciation of your parents before you got to school?
Well, I think my dad was the wild one in our family. And like I said, he sort of just went out there and went gung ho and just did anything, whether he had background or not. He bought businesses, ran them, just sort of, it was always kind of like moving on his feet to do something. And he was never afraid and, you know, just went out there. And then he had a lot of ups and downs too. So I always saw him like, oh my God, like we got to deal with this. And oh my God, this is going bankrupt. We got to deal with that. So yeah, you know, watching him was always that. And my mom, on the other hand, was the one who was like, education, you have to figure everything out, get the best you possibly can, push yourself so that you get as far as you can. And that'll give you a good foundation. So she was that solid point, and she was the one who, you know, put us in private school when we were young, and did some of those things to just help push further.
What a great balance you had between the two of them.
I'm also kind of feeling like I'm gonna make a call here. I'm gonna say like you're more like your dad.
it might be. Yep, probably. Although my boyfriend tells me I'm a lot like my mom now. So I don't know. I think it all comes both. But yeah, in terms of like getting out there and just, you know, not being afraid, just saying, all right, let's just tackle what's ahead. Definitely.
So some part of me recalls that you ended up in like France or Paris or something.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Talk us through that time. Was that after, did you study abroad? Was it after college? What was it?
That was after my MBA. So I started my career out from Wellesley in finance in Chase Manhattan Bank in New York.
Wow.
Because my dad always said, you got to know your numbers. But after doing that a couple of years, I was like, is this all there is? There's got to be more excitement. So I went back to, you know, I got my MBA in marketing. Said that'll help me deal with product creativity, all that. And then I decided, well, as long as I'm being creative, let's just go to France. I always wanted to learn French and be fluent in it. And I did my MBA and got an additional degree at Lauder, the Lauder Institute at Wharton, which you learn a language, you focus on an area and all that. And then I ended up in Paris, which was, you know,
beautiful.
You know, you talk about, yes, you do these specific career plannings, but really I just wanted to go and live in Paris.
It's a beautiful.
So I wasn't aware of the whole, and by the way, Chase Manhattan Bank sounds very like old. But anyway, so how long were you in finance? A couple of years? What was that like?
That was 4 years. And actually it was the most amazing job in the whole world. They had this, you know, back in the day, they trained you for a year in banking. And then I did a job called credit audit, where I traveled with a bunch of my peers, all our age, like right out of college. And we went around the world to sort of look at how healthy our different bank units were. So I spent time in Thailand and Switzerland and Chile. And then, you know, after every assignment, you'd have like 2 weeks off that you just stay in the country and travel. So it was like, so for basically for 2 years on that job, I just traveled around the world.
Incredible.
And got paid. I'm telling you, this was like the home run of first jobs. I mean, I was one of the last in college to get a job. I'm like, oh my God, I'm not going to get a job after all this. And then I found that one, and it was like, you know, I felt like I manifested it. I sort of sat down and was like, what is the perfect job after college? You're like, somewhere where you can travel and da-da-da, do all that. And I found it.
I know. Well, most people don't. They take those elementary sort of steps, and they're not that glamorous, and they're, you know, and then they find their way. You actually had a nice taste of it before. Deb, I just have to ask you, at that stage, after Wellesley or while you're in Paris, was the auto industry or cars in general or anything like that in your mind? Like, oh, back home one day or four. Okay. Yeah, it wasn't, you didn't, we'll come back to that. We can continue with the story. Yeah. What were your favorite moments in Paris other than like everything there, beautiful art, food, and are you fluent today in French?
Yep, I still am. I speak it pretty well. Little rusty.
Bill is as well. Bill is actually one of the best.
Oui, oui.
J'aimerais bien parler français.
By the way, I had to, Deb was inducted into some Hall of Fame, and she asked me to give the intro speech. And I wanted to like bring up like her. So like I kept trying to pronounce this one word, and I practiced it all day. And as I was going walking up the stage, I was still practicing it, and I think I didn't butcher it, but like that's the extent of my French.
That was so impressive. When you said that, and you said it with the perfect accent, it's a hard word. It's joie de vivre, like joy of life, and you said it perfectly. I was like, whoa! Yet another side of Bill that I did not know existed.
Joie de vivre.
No, that was hours worth of practice just to say those like two or three words. But actually, let's talk about that. Because I don't know, even know how I remembered something like that. I think it was on a panel that you had at Mediocean. But talk a little bit about that. What does it mean? What's the phrase again?
So it's joie de vivre, but it sort of means like follow your bliss, find your bliss, like what makes you happy in life and what, you know, what creates that idea. And it was actually one of my headmistress in eighth grade who sort of put that word and idea in front of me that's how you should frame your life up. So if you find yourself in a place where you're not following that or feeling that, then you should change and leave. And it's amazing, like it's all the, you know, we're business people and we think about that. But if you don't have that side of it, it's got to be somewhere in your life. And ideally, it's in the work that you do, too. And I've sort of followed that. That's why my career is a kind of a crazy mix. You know, anytime I go to a professional, like I went to a Wharton panel on job career pathing. And the professor looked at me, he's like, you're a disaster. Like your career, it doesn't follow any of the things that we tell people to do. And I was like, but I followed my joie de vivre.
It's like an artist.
Joie de vivre.
Yes. Yeah. That's so great. That's such great advice.
So you basically used Chase to move to Manhattan and travel all over the world. You didn't find your joie de vivre there. So you found yourself getting an MBA, you're in Paris, now what?
Yeah.
Like I'm so curious as to how Detroit comes back in your life.
Okay. Yeah. It's coming. Well, Paris was amazing. So I went there working for W.L. Gore, which is a fascinating company. You know, they have like a couple beliefs, which is make money and have fun. And then while you're doing that, don't sink the boat. And that's pretty much it. And so I was hired to be part of this new group. We were developing a product for people with allergies to dust mites, and it was made out of Gore-Tex material. So it's basically bed covering, bed sheets. And we were launching it across Europe in the allergy market. And I was in charge of the French market, which is just like, I give them so much credit for hiring me. Like I spoke fluent French, but I'd never worked in France. I'd never, you know, done any of that. And they they took a bet on me and were like, go for it. And so there I am, like right out of my MBA. I had finance experience, but I was starting this business. And so I was all over France. I met all the top hospital people, the top allergies. I started clinical trials. I, you know, developed a supply chain in the pharmacy business, had to get a sales force going. It was fascinating. I mean, it was probably the best years. And then in addition to that, you're living in France, of course, in Paris, which is the most beautiful city in the world with the most amazing food. And, you know, it's so easy to travel. I'm a huge travel buff. And so we were traveling every weekend with a huge group of friends, wherever everyone was single, they were running around. It was fun.
You had sounds like you had a lot of autonomy at that stage in your life, as far as from a career perspective.
Yeah.
Unlike, you know, traditional jobs where you're young and it's very kind of meeting after meeting reporting and very linear. It sounds, if I heard you correctly, you had a lot of freedom and autonomy with this gig.
Yeah. So it was. Now, the bad part of it is, of course, that after 3 years, I didn't sell enough. of those products in the French market to support. But I think, you know, having experience like that when I was younger taught me, just gives you a ton of confidence about making decisions and trying things and realizing that in business, you just like doing is better than researching and thinking, and you've got to get out there and just get into action in a lot of ways. So it taught me that. But yeah, I ended up back in Detroit because after 3 years of that job, I was hired as a local. I was not an expat or anything. And I did that because I wanted the job. But I couldn't pay my business school bills. I couldn't pay back my loans.
Those things.
I was like, oh God, oh no. So then, I really have to come back. And I need to come back to the States, and I need to, you know, think. And it was, well, that was all fascinating. I loved the experience. Like W.L. Gore is an amazing company. But at the same time, I was like, I probably need some more guidance at this stage in my career. I'm kind of doing things and learning on the fly, but it might be good to, you know, learn from a little more structure.
Yeah.
So I came back and I started interviewing for marketing jobs. And
can I interrupt you on one thing real quick?
Because
I think it's important. That you're now that I'm learning a little bit more about you and the fact that you're CMO and you're a global company, and we'll get to that. But living in Europe and spending time there, I was born in Finland, so my mother's side Scandinavian, I think is such an advantage when you can see the world from the other side of the pond, and you become less American. And arguably, you're one of the most, you know, American brands and the most American cities on the planet. But I think when you can see people from that lens, it gives you some unique advantages. And I just want to kind of tip my hat to that, but also it'll be interesting to see where you take us next on your journey. But I don't know if you agree, but.
Totally. I think that actually as a marketer, working in another country I was a much better marketer in those days because I was in a country where I didn't have any preconceptions about the culture or what people think. I mean, you're studying all the time and you're learning from that. And then it really opened my eyes when I got much better at speaking French about understanding that when you speak in different languages, you think differently. So the way the French language is structured and how they're taught to think critically is really different. And to me, that was really helpful. Like, you know, in France, for any businessman, you argue on basically three points. Like you have to, it's a three-step argument, and that's how you present everything, and you really learn. And so I think it taught me that one, there's no right way about addressing or solving a problem. There's no right approach. You have to be really creative and think in a lot of different ways from different perspectives. So I agree with you. Like, to me, that was also on the career side, one of the most invaluable experience that I got from that. Yep.
Okay. Sorry. So now you're back in Detroit before I cut you off.
Yeah. Well, I still wasn't ready actually really to go back to Detroit, but I started interviewing in a lot of different places for marketing jobs. And I so remember this. And again, no issue against anyone else, but I had two back-to-back interviews set up. And one was in Chicago for Kraft. And I was in there interviewing about, you know, Cheese Whiz and all the a potential marketing job on the Cheese Whiz brand and the different, you know, product extensions they had for that. And it was a beautiful company and gorgeous. And then the next day I flew to Detroit. And basically, we got to Detroit. They picked us up from the airport because there were a couple of people interviewing, and then took us directly to the test track. And at that time in Detroit, you still had active test tracks. So from
genius recruiting tactic.
Genius. So then there I am, like on the test track, zooming around.
Were you thinking about Cheese Whiz at the time when you were doing on the track? No, sorry.
Exactly. So then you're like, after that, I was like, oh my God, this is so exciting. This is awesome. You know, there's so much, so dynamic and interesting, and the people were great. And this was at Ford at the time, and they had this amazing program. And so that sort of pushed aside all those, like, no, I'm not ready to go back to Detroit. The auto industry is, you know, all male and all that. It was just so fun and dynamic that it definitely appeared the best place to go. And then when I got into the interviews, I also said, well, you know, I've been in France and I know Europe and I worked all over Europe, so I'd like to go to Latin America. And they were basically like, okay, cool, no problem.
Oh, Bill, we lost your audio for a minute, but I'll wait to hear you in a minute. Deb, I'm just hearing in the context of you're basically, if someone's listening to this, you're basically telling people what you want and then things are happening. So I don't want to jump to conclusions with what your superpowers are of kind of putting magic dust on people and them giving you what you want. But how do you get how do you ask to go to Latin America and that happens? And did you actually go?
Yeah, I did. You know, I don't know. I do believe in the fact that if you really know what you want and you ask people to help you get that can happen. And now it also helped that I was actually dating someone who was in Latin America at the time. But yeah, I think it's amazing. And then again, I really wanted to round out, and you know, I was studying international business, that it was really important at the time, and so felt like I really had to understand. And actually, I thought I was going to Argentina. You know, Buenos Aires is lovely, like Paris, you go. And then I somehow ended up in Brazil because Rogelio Goldfarb, the guy from Ford, recruited me and just convinced me that it was very exciting, and I ended up in São Paulo.
I apologize. I've been having such audio issues over here. I tried to connect by phone and then you couldn't hear me. I apologize. You know, one of the things that has struck me is I probably think you probably have a lot of partners and customers on the phone that work with you, Deb. They probably had no idea that you didn't work your way up through the marketing ranks, that you started in finance. You went into product management and project management. You went to different markets. How much of that different experience do you think makes you a better CMO today?
Yeah. I think, you know, like you, I think the best things that we do are talk to a lot of people, understand, network, be curious all the time, and understand how all these different things fit together. And what's interesting, if you're a marketer, the commonality of all that is understanding people and behaviors across mm-hmm. the world, what motivates them and what they do. So yeah. That's what I found that's really helped me, and never, you know, just doing the job in front of you, but thinking bigger because you're curious and active and really want to get involved. Now, the downside of that is you got to work a lot harder, like, you know, because yeah. you're always busy, you know, and typically you're out all the time with people so that you have time to talk and go. But to me, that's what really all of that taught me. And I'm still friends and stay in contact with people from all these experiences around the world because that really helps.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting because there used to be such a hierarchy to organizations and jobs, you know, and now it's kind of, you have to work as hard or if not harder than the people that work for you. And you got to stay connected, even though you have thousands of people in your org and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's fascinating. So, okay. I want to speed it up a little bit here. So, because I do want to get to some of the current events, but so you find yourself back in Detroit. You know, you did, you know, just briefly talk about kind of the roles you had when you found yourself back in Detroit. And I know you ended up going to a real estate construction company or something like that.
And McDonald's. I got to find when you had time for McDonald's as well.
Okay, yeah. I'm going to give you the short thing. So in automotive, typically there isn't a marketing track. You know, so you're really, typically you're a generalist, but I loved marketing and decided that, you know, early on that that's what I wanted to focus on. So for me, opportunity to get more responsibility came from actually opportunities to move to different companies. So I started Ford in Brazil. Ford bought Mazda. I went to Mazda in California. Did some really great work there. If I say so myself, I really thought it was good. And from there, I went to Lincoln Mercury, my first tack at American Luxury for cars. And then Toyota hired me. That I thought was a great opportunity, incredibly well-run company. Just so much to learn from the way that the Japanese approach business and what they do. Spent a lot of time in Japan. And then finally, I had it was great. And then I became vice president of marketing for Lexus, which was like a dream job. It was just so good. And we were doing so much great innovative work and in everything, and content and media, all kinds of things. And then I got the call to potentially come back to Chrysler. And we always have these fateful decisions we make in our life.
Oh, yes.
And I remember thinking, like, gosh, it would take me back home. My son was 5 at the time. I could really bring all this learning and this perspective to Chrysler. My dad had, you know, been the plant manager at Chrysler, come back to an American car company and really contribute that way. And I remember talking to my colleagues at Toyota, and they're like, what are you, like, why are you going there? And I think it was a little two things at the time, a little bit of ego because I wanted to advance faster. And at Toyota, there was no other marketing role to go into.
Yeah.
And, you know, and this sort of challenge about, can you bring some of this diverse learning and can it help somewhere else? Like, can you transfer that? But that was my fateful decision because I joined at the end of 2007, in October, October 2007, came back to Detroit, joined Chrysler, and we were like going gangbusters for the first 6 months. And then, of course, the world dropped out, fell apart.
Isn't it
so
wild?
Basically, what you're saying is, you know, when you are the CMO of an auto company, just wait 6 to 9 months and we'll go through like the worst recession in history. Because now you've done that twice.
Exactly. Oh, no, I didn't even put that together. But thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, that's what we're here for, Deb.
Bill, you may have preluded her superpower. She predicts she's a recession predictionist. I'm going to make up that word.
Oh, my God, this is going to be so bad for me.
OK, so by the way, at that point, is your dad still working?
No, he was definitely gone by then, long gone.
Okay.
He started his company and gone through a lot. Nope, he wasn't in the business anymore. But he was, you know, obviously he was incredibly proud at that point.
Yeah, I could imagine.
Did you have any mulligan jobs in your career, or is this thing going to be like, you know, just pristine? Did you have any like kind of moments before your auto executive roles where things were like, ah, that's okay, or any sort of moments that you're like, yep, that was a great learning or a mistake or whatnot, anything like that you want to share?
Well, I think it ended up being the Chrysler, you know, job.
Right.
I had been, you know, if I had still stayed at Toyota, which again had a great management team, etc., things would, like, my whole career trajectory would have been a lot different. And some of them told me, they're like, yes, we had full pension and, you know, we had all this, but I was like, no, I'm going to go. It's private equity owned. I'm going to make a whole bunch of money. I'm going to do this and that. And, you know, that's what fateful experience, like fateful choice. And that changed my whole career and world and life overall.
Like, when you're making decisions on leaving, it's a very difficult decision. Like, some of the most stressful things in life are, like, the decision to leave a job, the decision to move to a different country or city, and the decision to have children. Those are, like, the three most, like, stressful parts of adulthood.
Should I join the Superpowers podcast show? But that's number 4.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes, yes. And so, like, you seemingly did, like, all of them, like, multiple times. Like,
all the time.
So what drove your decision, right? Because a lot of people get comfortable. And sometimes if you get too comfortable, you lose that drive to kind of continually, you know, increase your career. Like, what was it? Was it financially driven? Was it experience driven? Was it like, there's not enough women in executive jobs in, you know, Detroit? Like, what was it that drove you to make such these stressful decisions of, like, constantly jumping around?
Yeah, I often ask myself that. And some, you know, from just ends up what the circumstances are. But I think the majority is I wanted to find a challenge that I could sink my teeth into and make a difference on. And, you know, as I looked at opportunities, it was, can I help this company grow? Can I help change the way we do business? Can we do something like that? And certainly with the first time when I came back to Detroit was, for me, really personal. It was like, can I really help? I didn't think at that time, of course, we could see a lot of challenges for the U.S. auto industry. And I wanted to see if I could come back and make a difference. And that's part of it, because obviously I didn't make enough of a difference in that role. So I was still looking, you know, 10 years later is when I came back to Detroit after that. You know, so I think some things are in you forever. You just have to figure out how to do it. And what I always say to all of my team is like, this might be a great idea, but there's always the right time for the great idea. And either you have to keep pushing until it becomes that time, or you have to keep holding on to it and then find when the context is right and come back and try again.
Yeah, Deb, can you talk a little bit about your, you mentioned your son, how many children do you have? When, what part did that phenomenal event happen of having kids or a kid? I'm not sure yet, we'll find out. And how did you navigate that period as relates to your rise?
Oh yeah, that's a whole nother story. But so I only have one son, I do remember having many conversations because I was pregnant with him when I'd just taken my first sort of big marketing job at Toyota. And some of my peers and colleagues were like, you're out of your mind. Like, there's no way you can do this. Impossible. And then others actually really helped me by saying, no, you just manage it like any of your projects. Like, you sit down with your boss, you lay out when you're going to be on leave, like what's going to happen, who's going to take care of it. And like, the more I handled it like that, the more manageable it was. It was like this huge, amazing insight that someone shared with me. And that's how I got through it. And the same thing with, like, you know, people always tell me, don't be afraid to ask for help. So if you need help at home or a nanny or whatever, like, do it, but then manage it like you do professionally. And really think about those things. So, yeah. And then this is the best thing. Oprah told me this. She told me, whenever your son walks in the room, make sure your eyes light up. So in other words, like, stop everything else you're doing and focus on your child. Yep.
That's great. Love that.
Yep. Yep. And that, like, you know, it made a huge difference. And then make sure you don't, like, if you're a working mom, make sure if you come home and say, oh my God, I hated my job and it was horrible, your kids are going to feel that. If you come home and tell how much you gained out of life and the things that you're working on that are important to the world, all that, your kids, they feel that, and then they feel very different about you and working. And so
they're a part of it, not on the sideline. And if you think I'm not going to ask you why Oprah's not on your speed dial, you're crazy. Let's talk about your Oprah BFF.
I wish. All I know is, like, I could spend just a small amount of time with her, luckily, because of the position I was in, and it was worth every, I mean, it was amazing, yeah. Like, amazing impact that, you know.
We all need 5 minutes with Oprah. We talk about, you know, this podcast is all about superpowers. Like, I think, like, working moms are, like, they're the true superheroes, right? Because it's so difficult. And I even during kind of the COVID crisis, you know, I was very mindful to reach out to the young parents who had to homeschool their kids during this time, you know. So, you know, like, because, like, the easiest thing to do is just go to work, right? It's like, you know, but people who had to stay home, it's like, you now have to homeschool your kids, you now have to cook multiple meals per day, which is a whole nother full-time job, and you got to do your job. It's like so difficult. So it's incredible that, you know, you had a son and you continue to move around. All right, let's get to McDonald's. Okay. Let's get to McDonald's, cause then we got to get to GM. You also did leave. So you left the auto industry for two different jobs. So talk about the first one, then talk about McDonald's.
Yeah, it was end of 2008, 2009, obviously the biggest depression everywhere. There was no work to be done at Chrysler because we had no money. We weren't going to be doing any marketing. Yep. And so I left the company then. And there I am in Detroit. I'm like, oh God, what am I going to do now? And you have that sense of panic. Like, I think when you were talking about that, first sense of like, oh my God, this has never happened to me before. Like, I had nothing else. So two things I learned there is, like, you should always be thinking about potential future and different paths that you can go on. no matter what, no matter how good things are, and be prepared. And then the second was that, you know, after the initial panic and, oh my God, just really finding out what I wanted to do. So I tried some consulting work. Michael Kasson was generous. He gave me some work there. I tried some other things, and I was like, I am horrible at this. Like, I am no good at this. I've got to refocus. And amazingly enough, I looked around. I was contacted by a headhunter for this job at Pulte Group, which was here in Detroit, 5 minutes from my home, and they wanted a CMO. And, you know, I love architecture. I love houses and buildings and all that. And so for me, that was a great motivator, because I thought, why not understand like all this and what it does? And it was cool because I went from like a $1 billion budget to maybe less than $20 million.
Had to work hard.
You had to work hard. We had to do everything ourselves. It was kind of actually refreshing when you have been at the high leadership levels like that to then go with a really small team and then just think about what you could transform. And I do feel like we really transformed the way that the company did marketing. They weren't digitally oriented at all. We put that all in. We changed the focus from like focused on holidays, like, you know, when you get the real estate card that's on Mother's Day or Valentine's Day, you're like, why am I getting this now? Like, so, you know, we helped that to change and get online and do a lot of really cool things. We focused on life inspired designs and created rooms in the homes that are really that I've seen spread out across the industry, which has been really cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah. But then, of course, fate comes in again. Pulte decides to move to Atlanta. I had wanted to stay here in Michigan. You come to that crossroads. And then I got a call from McDonald's. And I was like, no way. Like, no way. First, you know, there's no way. Because that would ramp it way back up and go to the other thing. But then it was this whole thing. Like, I couldn't resist the challenge. It was like an American icon. It needed, it needed to transform. It was like, it was, you know, great people, franchisee situation. I thought I was, you know, I'd been very used to that with the car business. And so it was just one of those challenges. I was like, I'm crazy. But, you know, when they offered me the position, I said, absolutely.
And so you were CMO of McDonald's for 3 years, right?
Yep.
And what was like your proudest moment there? Because, I mean, it's an interesting time. Like, McDonald's obviously is an incredible American icon, now global icon. But it also intersected when the world started going down like the healthy path. So, like, what were the obstacles, and what were you most proud of during your work at McDonald's?
Yeah, I think most proud of like actually using classic marketing strategies, et cetera, to really help define where to go. And we identified a couple things that we really needed to get on the healthy eating path at McDonald's, and we actually made changes to all of the food. So we took out all the preservatives and colors and all of those elements. We really focused on bringing like core things back. So the egg McMuffin started being buttered with real butter again, and it was delicious. And we changed the English muffin that went with it, and did all that, which I thought was really important work. But then what was really, for me, the biggest learning option, we identified early on this opportunity for all day breakfast. And, you know, we just looked at, I asked the team, I was like, what are people complaining about the most on, or what are they asking for in social media? And, you know, it was hundreds of thousands of people who said they wanted all day breakfast. You know, and so that was like the easy part. But then it took a year and a half to figure out, how do we operationalize this and really work through all those details? And that was the first time, as I think CMO roles have changed, to really be involved with the business. And, you know, you have to figure all that out. So that was really working hand to hand with the teams and the franchisees, the owner operators, negotiating, figuring out, how do we do this? It's actually very, very complex to serve breakfast and lunch at the same time in a fast food restaurant.
Well, I can't imagine. Thousand locations, franchisees, there's a training component. My wife is British, Deb, and literally once a week we'll have eggs on toast, because that's kind of their jam in England. And it's not a bad thing when you have like a lazy meal you want to eat. I do have a question, because I'm sure there's a lot of people that are listening or that will watch later that come from our circles, from ad tech and martech, media advertising. How in the world of sort of digital, specifically digital, how did you kind of see the world and any thoughts in regards to, you know, what you were doing from an online perspective? Obviously, everyone knows broadcast and auto, I think, continues to dominate, you know, the percentage of spend with television. But how did you think about how do you think about the online space through your career and the importance of digital?
Yeah, great question.
Yeah, I think I've, you know, talked about a lot. We started a lot of things at many companies, but actually the technology until now hasn't really been capable of keeping up with the goals that we had. So I've been talking about personalization for probably 20 years and how do we do that? And how do we deliver the right message at the right time to the right people? So it's really fascinating to me because I think just now we have all the pieces in place. Many companies like General Motors, we've been investing in the tech stack and the data stack for the last 18 months at a super, probably 24 months at a really significant level. And now we can do this. So the idea of having all the channels converge, making sure we can get dynamic creative and know our people and have propensity audiences, it's finally, you know, at this time that as a CMO, I've been preparing and working on this for two decades. And I feel like we can finally deliver now.
You mentioned, Bill, one more point on that. You mentioned social media earlier. And I just want to ask you too, in regards to the importance of social, specifically from a listening perspective, like what your customers are saying. How do you think about, you know, social as far as all the traditional platforms of Twitter or Facebook or where else where you got, it's important to hear what customers are saying.
Yeah, well, we've really doubled down on that, especially through COVID, which was all of a sudden, I think all of us were faced with, we're not sure where this is going to go. And obviously consumers were changing so fast. So at GM, we established these five phases. We thought first they'd go through panic, then people would need reassurance. Then we have entertainment needs while we're sequestered. Then we talked about recovery and then the new normal. We thought we were on recovery. Now with seeing where things are going, we're kind of in that middle phase. But we did that and then we started tracking socially every day what consumers were saying, what the reports were, comparing all the different sources, because I think we just have been through the most incredible movement in consumers' behaviors, what they're looking for, expectation, and all of us, sorry, need to be incredibly nimble right now. It's a time where there's no, you can't mourn the past and what you were going to do yesterday. We just have to really be looking at where people are today and getting our teams to move very, very fast to adopt and deliver what consumers need.
I was on a call earlier today, and I'm going to plagiarize, but I'm going to acknowledge that I'm plagiarizing a statement that has been like in my head all day, which is, you know, marketers need to market the way consumers consume. And I think we've known that for 10 years, but, you know, we just haven't gotten there from an infrastructure, technology, data perspective. Everything seems to be siloed. And I almost feel like the last 4 months we've potentially gained 4 years of advancement, in these last 4 months. So I want to hit that. But I also just want to finish the story. So you do your stint at McDonald's, but clearly whether it's a want or it's just a cosmic force pulling you back, you end up back, you know, in Detroit. Actually, I remember you telling me that you were taking the CMO job of Cadillac, and you're going back to Detroit. No, you said, actually, I'm going to Cadillac, but I'm actually moving to New York City because Cadillac is headquartered in New York. And I actually remember what you said. You said, I'm exchanging my 6,000 square foot house in Michigan for a 600 square foot studio in Tribeca for basically the same cost.
Yeah, that was pretty much it. Yeah. Although that move was much bigger. I had a whole, after I left McDonald's, that was a whole year of introspection about what do I really want to do and what do I want to contribute in life? Because despite all the fun of all this, but it's really serious, like what's happening in the world today, where we can all or where we should all put our talents to use. And I looked at my hometown, Detroit, was really impressed with what Mayor Duggan has been doing to develop and said, I really want to be part of that. And then I looked at General Motors, which has Mary Barr as its CEO. We have a Divya, who is our chief financial officer, it's really a completely different company than it was back in the 80s than when I did my internship there. And yes. What they're doing is amazing, powerful, and transformative. And to me, that capability, you always have to decide at one point, where do you really put your time and effort? And especially for someone like me who's been so itinerant all my life, I was like, it's time for me to put some stakes in the ground and really focus and start contributing as much as I can. And now with everything that's happened with the social injustice, COVID, yeah. All these impacts, to me, I think it makes it even more critical to think about how we contribute both personally through our companies, with the power we have as voices in the media world and how much that impacts perceptions. I think it's a unique time for anyone in our business to make an incredible difference and really think we have to create business and drive growth, but we also have to create the world that our kids should live in.
Deb, something like 30,000 ventilators ring a bell. I mean, where were you? When did that, how did, do you kind of remember when you first heard that conversation come up, and that GM, the company that you're working at, is going to basically rethink, re-engineer how your plants work and operationalize? I watched the 60 Minute segment. I still admit it. I'm sure a lot of people, you know, I still think it's the best journalism on air. So I watched 60 Minutes, but I remember watching that and being like, I've never seen the level of overhaul that a company like that had to do to basically create a new product. I mean, basically a new product at such an important time. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, I think that's for me. So just to put in perspective, when I first came to General Motors and I started going around the company and understanding the stories of creativity, the passion, the level of engineering expertise, this is where I sort of said to the management, I'm like, these are the stories we have to tell. So I think it all came, I was in one place where we said, like, in times that are this tough, the soul of a company comes out. And the moves that our team members made to make that happen, and our new barometer is 18 days. It was 18 days from the first meeting with Ventec until we actually were able to start putting the manufacturing pieces in place. And within 30 days, we were manufacturing. That tells you about the caliber, the force, the belief, the purpose-driven nature of the men and women who work at General Motors. And to me, just solidifies why I made the choice to be part of this company and contribute. And I think that shows, you know, again, just like I was talking, if you think about the talents that we all have, what we can bring to bear for society, our culture, when things really get tough, how we come together and achieve things like that. I mean, people gave up their retirements, they worked day and night, they put their talents to work for something to solve a major issue for humanity. And all I can say is, like, I'm in awe of all of our team members who did that.
Yeah, that is such an incredible, you know. I think right now, you know, within the media, so much of the bad stuff is being exploited, and so much of the good stuff isn't being celebrated. And by the way, it also talks to, you know, marketing, you know, used to be kind of an expense line item, and now marketing is a P&L job, right? It is managing your own business. It's understanding, you know, everything from consumer behaviors to, you know, what your capabilities are, listening to all these, you know, social signals. And so it now makes a lot more sense understanding your background. Like, you know, to be a CMO, there's a reason why tenure at the CMO job is the worst of any job level, because it's become a lot more complex, right? So let's just go back a little bit. So, because you went back to GM, but it was at Cadillac specifically, and you became CMO, and there was no CMO at General Motors. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah.
And so, what was the decision? What was the decision to recreate? Because there wasn't a CMO job at General Motors for like a long time.
Right.
Like, did someone come to you and say, hey, listen, we want to recreate the global CMO job and you're it? Or was it, You know, like what were the mechanics there? How'd you end up in this job?
You know, I think it's a good testament to the power of marketing and what we can really do and contribute to companies. And I think we've seen a lot of companies bring a global CMO in, then not, and not have it. But we can play a really critical role. And I think that's what Mary and Mark at General Motors, you know, decided that they wanted to do. How do we push forward these? One, make sure the stories from inside are known outside and that we're delivering that value. And in a world and time of transformation, this is for the auto industry, it's the most transformational time in my lifetime. Yeah. You know, we're going into EVs, autonomous. Our technology is far advanced. I mean, like you and in the software business, like things are happening today that we never thought would happen so fast and furiously. And so I think, you know, when that happens, we have to transform everything, not only the way we work internally, but the way we communicate and engage. And so I think it just made a lot of sense. And I feel very fortunate that I was in that place at the time, because, again, I think as the deeper I go into our company, the more of these stories that we have to tell. And we did something amazing. Like, we are very committed to electric vehicles and to that future. We think it's important for the world. We believe in a world of zero crashes, zero emissions, and zero congestions. We're going to do our part to help create that. And we sort of let the world see in the first week of March, our battery technology, our Ultium battery propulsion system, what we're doing and the advances, because people hadn't understood if you know, our company could do that or not. And when we revealed to it, they were I think impressed by the battery expertise, and blown away, and really realized what we're really doing and what was amazing. Of course, you know, talk about not mourning the past, that was the following week after that is when the pandemic was declared, and where we had to really pull back on everything we were doing and keep everyone safe. And we all started working from home, and the whole world changed at that point.
I'm impressed with what cars do today, and I'm not a car guy. I can't attest to knowing cars well, but like what cars do today impressed me. And it's fascinating to see the level of technology, both from a hardware and software perspective, that's being introduced. If you had to sort of identify one or two things that you're most excited about, whether it's here today or coming tomorrow, that you've been a part of those conversations, and maybe it's, you know, the batteries and you know, the emissions topic and what's good for the environment, what is that? And then the follow-up question to that is, what's the car that you can't be driving that you'd love to drive?
So I think, first of all, we have some incredible technology run by our autonomous driving group that is called Super Cruise. And it's, you know, it allows you to drive no hands, no feet. It's been introduced in Cadillac and the CT6. It's an incredible experience, but really that's just the beginning of the future. And the way our engineers have approached that is so advanced and really, really thoughtful, because while we all dive into all these technologies, we have to ensure people are safe. And I think we've seen that in, you know, many of, as technology develops, if we're not conscious of that in the very beginning, things can run rampant. Just look what's happening in our social platform world right now. So we're very intent on that and going. I think if you look at what we're doing, even with OnStar and the potential that that has, it was the first to do that. And as we think about staying safe everywhere as we drive and wherever we go, there's tons of opportunity there. And I think you'll start seeing our electric vehicles. We've teased the Hummer. It's an incredible vehicle that completely transforms itself and really brings all that technology to the fore. We have the Bolt EV from Chevy, which is incredible as well. It's one of the best on the road today. And we're going to make sure more people see more of that. And then we have many others coming. Cadillac will be our first brand to go all electric. And those vehicles are incredible. So I'm very excited about that. Overall,
what car should Bill be in, and what should I be in? Where do you see us? It's like summer cruising. Bill's got his hair kind of, you know, flopping back in the wind. Like, where?
By the way, My goal is by the time I get back to the office, my hair is going to basically be like Deb's. Like I'm going all down, you know.
What car do you see us both in?
Well, you know, certainly I can see Bill in the Hummer, and especially as you take, you know, as you can take the whole roof off and go, and you're going to be great. You know, Chris, I see you in the new Lyric Cadillac vehicle that's coming out. It's stunningly beautiful and amazing ride experience. But for both of you, while we're waiting for that, we still do have a lot of gas-powered vehicles that are fabulous. And on my list is the new mid-engine Corvette. It's okay. Nothing more beautiful. If you drive it, it fits you. You know, it doesn't just go around you. You fit into the vehicle and become part of it. And it's probably one of the best driving experiences around.
But what do you mean it's on your list? Can't you just like say, hey, I'm the global CMO. I'm just going to take this right now.
No, because we actually like our teams to buy the vehicles. I mean, yes, I can drive it anytime, but that's not the same thing as if you do it. Now, as you know, I bought this beautiful home that was from 1956, which has become my new money pit. So as soon as I do that, then the Corvette's my reward.
And Bill, I think it's called stealing if you just take a car off the lot. And
yeah. So, by the way, I feel like now I got to go buy a Hummer. So I'm gonna look into that. So, Deb, just getting to the current state, you know, we all recognize that at some point, you know, we will return back to quote unquote normal. But in other cases, we may not ever return to the normal that was pre-COVID. Like from a marketing perspective, because a vast majority of our listeners are connected to, you know, kind of marketing, advertising, ad tech, martech. Like, how do you see things going differently? Like, do you see the upfronts being different? Do you think, is omnichannel going to be managed differently? Like from a pure marketing perspective, what do you think the new normal needs to be?
Yeah, I think this is going to be a catalyst for all kinds of change. And we know since it landed right in the middle of the upfronts, which many of us have talked for years, that probably need to evolve. And as you know, we're also moving towards, you know, high propensity audience targeting. Really, we have so much data now that we really know where people are throughout the channels. And the platforms that we work with have to help us identify that and figure out, you know, how to achieve that. We're finding much higher levels of response rates from customers when we know that they have a propensity to be interested. We know what aspect they might be interested in. We deliver that message in the right way to them in that context. So I think this will jumpstart us completely. And the fact that the upfronts need to evolve in the way we've been doing it will help enormously. That go back to the idea of agility. We now use 18 days as our benchmark at GM. Everything is now, can you get it done in 18 days? Well, committing now for media buys and things that are, you know, three quarters out doesn't seem like it fits in our new agility model, especially as we don't know when content production will come back, when we can get there. So I think it'll force us all to really think about different models, and then using the baseline. We have found that it's been very productive to be in touch with people. Our first party channels have been incredibly productive. Obviously, we still need to get to wider audiences. So there's different ways, but I think the convergence of all these channels, how you get messages out, is the new normal that we're faced with. And the idea of agility and nimbleness is definitely part of the new normal.
So do you think, I mean, a staple of the TV, you know, so TV is generally, you think of a couple of verticals, you know, like you think of movie studios, auto, CPG, maybe, you know, beer, as kind of monopolizing kind of the TV upfronts. Do you think, and, you know, we're not holding to anything here, but do you think like the upfronts, you know, basically become like an iterative process and not kind of an annual process? Like, how are you thinking that, you know, especially if like you're, you know, the agility in 18 days, the idea of buying media a year in advance, you know, kind of doesn't seem to fit in there.
Yeah, I think, and I think especially since we, none of us know what's going to happen in the country over the next year. I mean, we're still seeing major events canceled and we can't get together. I always love interacting with you because you always spur my thinking. And I think we are going to need to go to that. And as we look at the ability to actually deliver faster, we don't have as much upfront timelines that we need to do, and how we have dynamic creative capabilities certainly fits into that model. And why shouldn't we be more agile as we all develop and go? And I think it would benefit the networks as well. So I think that's part of the reason why things are going a lot slower right now this year, because how can anyone, you know, make those definitive statements and commitments? I think we're all better if we start understanding this is the new normal. And finding ways to set that up.
And also there's a whole other, I guess, conversation in regards to how you deliver. Does the delivery change in this new world with these sort of, you know, these macro events that have been happening? How do you say things differently? Is the ad spot the same? Do you consider, hey, in this post-behavioral world? And I imagine all those things, I'm not a marketer. So I just imagine there's got to be some thought process that, said another way, doing it the way that it was 4 months ago doesn't sound right to me. You know, Something has to change.
I think we have a couple things. One, personally, people are much more focused on their health and safety. So That impacts their personal lives as well as how they view their business life. So the idea of, you know, traveling to all these events that we all did, do we really need to do that in the future, in the near future? Sometimes, actually, I think the virtual events and actual virtual productions, presentations, you get a ton more information. You can really see things in very different ways, show the technology very differently and effectively. So that's certainly helping. And then just overall, I think we've changed. You know, there hasn't been any real new TV production in how many months. And I think, you know, for the commercials, everyone's had a new expectation about what's a great commercial, what is it? And it's gone back to a focus of ideas and what's coming through instead of huge production values. So I think enormous opportunity with all those. I think we're going to need to use our platforms and our technology even more efficiently, make sure that all of our people are proficient and can really use all that. You know, I even think of Bill's platform.
The other thing too, I was going to say, I imagine what's happening now in the world of, like, are more, I imagine more cars would be sold, maybe less air travel. People are going to want to go, can drive 2 to 4 hours. Like, I'm just thinking about myself in the month of August, like Lake George, Maine, no flights overseas. So what's happened in macro? Are more cars being sold? And a little bit sort of the state of the state. I just have to think more people are getting to their cars. And that's a good thing for your business.
Yeah, it is. It's really interesting. I mean, clearly a decreased demand for ride sharing. I know I don't want my son doing that anymore. If I go anywhere, we're seeing even in New York that people are suddenly, the demand in New York has really ticked up because, you know, you don't want to be using those, or you're getting away on the weekends and where you're going and you're using your personal vehicles. So I think this whole definition of personal health and safety is going to change the way we look at transportation, what formats we want to use, and how we do that. We launched a couple of things with our dealerships, just a whole clean effort so that, you know, when you get into a car from the dealership, it has been completely sanitized, clean for you. So it's just different expectations already that people are going through. And I think it's really going to impact this younger generation. You know, we keep looking at how much do kids want to play on their games versus get in a car and drive? And for a while, there was a lot more gaming going on. Now, you know, I think the kids are, how much gaming can you possibly do? And they'll still do that, and that'll be effective channel. But, you know, the whole idea of...
Don't ask kids playing Fortnite that question, but everyone else will answer the other way.
So Deb, I want to we're coming up on time here. So I want to, you know, gear the conversation a little bit differently now. You know, one of the things that I've been appreciative of you being on the board of Mediaocean, you know, has been, you know, we just don't have enough women in senior executive leadership roles. We have even less at the board level, and we have even less in women in tech and STEM jobs. And there there, you gave a story once to the women of my company where you gave an example at a previous job, where you had, two very strong senior people, one a female, one a male, and you had to coach the female to kind of like speak up and be more aggressive. And, can you just talk, like, for all of our young female listeners, because it's 52% based on the registrations, like, what advice do you have for them in terms of making it in a world, either it's a technology world where it's a vast minority, it's the auto world where it's a vast minority, like, what advice do you have for them? And then I'm going to have another follow-up question.
Okay, the one thing I always say is, watch who speaks in the room, and then watch who you emphasize or build upon in the room. Because often women won't want to speak up in the room. So first thing I would say, take the seat at the table. I don't care what level you are, just step up and sit at the table or the Zoom or wherever it is. And then don't be afraid to speak up. And then if you are, especially women should be conscious of what their fellow women colleagues are saying and doing and build upon that. I think I learned from you guys, like, guys are great at building on each other's statements. That gives credibility. It helps it helps the conversation. For some reason, like, I realized mid-career that I had never learned that skill. And so, I think that's one thing that's really important. And then the other thing I learned, mid-career, I remember one guy saying to me, like, why is it always a fight with you? Why do you always have to be right? And I was like, well, because I am, but no, I'm kidding. But it was because, and then I realized, yeah, I was being too combative. Like, why don't I look at my colleagues as, I'm in it with them and helping them and develop that same personal relationship that I had with women or other things. And the more I've done that, I think that's really helped. Go on. It's a subtle thing, but I don't know. For me, it was always like, oh my God, I have to fight for my way in this male world. And that's not really that productive either. But I think you have to have really good allies and friends that give you, and people really tell you, like, one of my bosses was great. He was like, you've just irritated four of those people by making that statement. Like, you got to really think about how you're framing things and what you're saying and where mm-hmm. you go. And then I would just say, for the guys, take a risk on someone. People took a lot of risks on me in my career, and I did my best for them. And I think it turned out okay all around. And I'm always trying to tell myself that, like, give someone a chance, take a risk on someone who's eager and curious and wants to learn and is focused on problem solving. Give them more responsibility than you think they can take and see what happens.
So take a seat at the table, whether you're invited or not. Feel free to, speak up, add upon other people's conversations, and feel free to do that. And then for any of the male executives, take a risk on someone, and seek out, their input. Love it. I love that. Love that. Okay, one last question, then we got to wrap up. So if we were to interview you in another 10 years, what do you hope to accomplish? Where do you hope to be? What else? I feel like you're always looking forward and you're always challenging yourself. Yeah. Like, where is Deb going to be in 10 years?
Yeah, lots of, I have so many of those goals. So first of all, I want to help GM and contribute to the growth that we're going to achieve in that transformation. But also on that, I really am very committed to how are we going to eliminate racial injustice? How do we all, same way that you guys have helped and talked about women, how do we make sure for African-American, for diversity, that we actually do this, especially in the marketing industry? So I'm really focused on that. I clearly want to contribute and potentially work in Detroit or do something in that area. As we go along. And then finally, I'm just going to make sure that I'm going to keep doing yoga so I can make sure that I have the energy to do all this stuff. Yeah, exactly. But I think, right now it's a time for all of us to seriously think about what we can contribute and how we can truly make a difference in our society. I think everyone has a role to play and we need more people talking up. During the crisis after George Floyd's murder, I had a lot of really unbelievably powerful, poignant, incredible conversations with our African-American employees who taught me personally a lot about the situation we're still living in today, made me aware of, even though I, you know, thought, oh, I've been helping, that there's so much more that I can personally be doing. So I hope that we can all do that and align together and just make, you know, take this issue off the table.
Yeah, Deb, I appreciate you calling that out. And I know Bill and I both feel very strongly on that, and a lot of self-reflection being white men and acknowledging privilege, which has never come out of my mouth, and also acknowledging not being aware of how bad things have been. So yeah, we've all been on kind of, I think, of our own journey and to get things right, but I couldn't agree with you more. It's absolutely critical for leaders to voice their concerns and the importance of change and to call shit out when they see it. So I think it's great that you you brought that up before we wrap up.
Yeah, okay, so now it's the interesting part of the podcast where we get to reflect and talk about Deb's superpower. So I'm going to do a little summary, and then I'm going to pass it off to Chris, and then I'll add my pieces. So, you know, here's what we learned. You know, Deb learned her management skills early. She was bossing her two siblings around. You know, she was an above average student, didn't kill it, but was responsible. And it seemed like she, you know, understood the importance during school, that it's not just about grades, it's about your network as well. So very social, learned the importance of having a network there, maybe at this, you know, at the spite of her grades. She's an international woman of mystery. I had no idea that you've conquered every continent. You know, you found yourself in Detroit, which is kind of like its own country. You know, you went to Paris, you then came back to the U.S., you went to Latin America, you then worked for a Japanese company, found yourself in Asia. So you really have all of that experience. You didn't grow up in marketing. You had finance background. You then had some, you know, product and project management background, and found your way into marketing after getting an MBA, which was really an excuse to go to France and live in Paris. You jump around, you take risks. You know, this has been awesome. And now it makes a lot more sense, you know, kind of how you go about, you know, prioritizing things. I know you as, you know, being, you know, what I love about Deb is she, you know, because I have her in my board meetings, you know, you don't need to be the loudest person in the room or say the most things or take up the most oxygen. She is as good a listener as she is a leader. And you know, whenever I call on you, you know, you always have an answer. So it's like, I know that stuff is going on up there. And so, you know, so this has been incredible. Chris, what do you think Deb's superpower is after all of that?
I mean, so all is difficult, Deb. This is why they don't pay us enough money to run this show. But so what I've learned, and by the way, I've really enjoyed getting to know you and can't wait to spend time with you in person one day. You know your community. And you know your home. So you have your home roots of being in Detroit and your hometown girl. I actually think what's interesting about your story is between France and Latin America and your trips to Tokyo and all these other places, and what I kind of tipped my hat to earlier, is you have a very important global perspective at this very important time, but you're a hometown girl, and you're specifically hometown girl as it relates to Michigan and the auto industry. So I think your superpower is you've brought a global perspective to the auto industry and to your home roots of Michigan. If you were doing this job in another part of the country, then it wouldn't add up and I'd have a different superpower, but that's what I think your superpower is.
By the way, I don't like to agree with Chris. I love the bring the global experience to the local town. I love that. I also think, you know, calculated risk-taking is very, very difficult. And having the grit to do it. And so, You know, so I also, you know, feel like I got to add a little bit of you have throughout your career, have taken calculated risks, with that global experience, with a level of tenacity that, you know, I think most people are scared to do. But all that being considered, I actually think it's bringing the global experience to Detroit. Is it? I think, you know, at the end of the day, Detroit is in your DNA. You're redoing what looks like a beautiful home there. I can't wait to be invited. You know, it seems like every time you leave Detroit, there is a force bringing you back. And it's super, super important to have perspective in this day and age. You know, perspective on the social injustice, perspective of being, you know, a woman in an industry that's, you know, really monopolized by men, and having that global experience and bringing it, you know, to your local town and to Detroit. I'm going to have to agree with Chris. I love it. I've loved having, every time I speak to Deb, I learn a little bit new, something new, which I love. I apologize to the viewers for me having some audio problems here, but this has been great, and thank you so much. And Deb, what do you think? What do you think of our feedback on your superpower?
I love it. It's funny when you said it, I was like, oh yeah, that was the whole point of my whole life that you guys just get encapsulated. So thanks. And now I've really got to make good on it, because now, like, we put that out there in the universe. Now I've really got to make sure some things happen. So
back to work.
We'll be back to work.
You're doing great things, Deb, with your company and in life. You're good people, and we enjoyed having you today. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much. Thanks, everyone. This is it. Thank you for joining Superpowers Podcast with Deborah Wall. Bye, everyone.
Superpowers.